everybody wants a wine brand, right? There are a lot of partnerships in wine with musicians and artists of all types, including athletes. I think it generates excitement and interest for the space, and so that excites me. Whether it turns into actual hard dollar sales, less so, because don't forget, the average American, we drink wine in less than a 24-hour period. We go, we buy it, and then we drink it, versus in other societies, they store their wine.
Welcome to another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast, The Cusp Show, where we talk about the business of sports and disruption, technology, innovation, marketing, all different kinds of things. I'm Joe Favorito. I am flying solo this week as Tom Richardson, my co-host, is off doing business things that make money, probably selling some of his virtual horse racing. But Tom Cerny is sitting in as our producer again this week. And today we're going to talk a little bit about a business we really haven't talked about on top of it, but also kind of brand reinvention. But we haven't touched on the wine and spirits business. We've done a little bit about beer, but the vastness of that business and how a little bit it ties not just to sports, but to lifestyle is one thing we're going to touch on. But we're also going to talk a little bit about Olympic experience and social responsibility, all different kinds of things. But we will start it off with a little bit of wine. And our guest today is Caroline Shaw. Caroline is a longtime friend, but just started a new kind of step in her career with the Gallo Wine family. So, Caroline, welcome to the Cusp Show.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to be here.
There we go. So, like I said, why don't we start it off kind of at the beginning? Your career has touched on so many things, you know, consumer in the housing business, some of the social responsibility stuff that you've done, working both at the NBA for the Miller family and the Utah Jazz, and with the Salt Lake Olympics working for Mitt Romney at one point. So can you kind of walk us through how the heck you got here and all the wine you've consumed along the way at not one wine stop, but another one as well?
You know, I like to tell people my mom was a gypsy Joe and I grew up moving all the time. And I think that gave me a cadence to know to be very adaptable and curious. You know, at an early age, we were learning about the looking at the Greek coffrelis and learning about architecture. And there were a lot of wine glasses along the way, to be honest with you, because wine is very much a cultural aspect of life, and it's meant to be enjoyed in moments that matter. So that sort of international upbringing led me to getting a degree in international relations, which I would tell all your student listeners, don't let your degree drive what you do in your life, because my graduate degree is in Middle Eastern studies, but here I am managing corporate communications and brand marketing for the largest winery in the world. So I started at the State Department and switched to the UN, which was an incredible experience. And then I had the great honor to go work for the 2002 Olympic Winter Games with Mitt Romney. He taught so much about the importance of bringing the world together in this very confusing world. It was 6 months after 9/11, probably the best job I ever had. Fell in love with Utah and stayed, as you mentioned, with the Utah Jazz. And then along the way, someone said, hey, you know a lot about international relations and wine. Would you like to come west and move to California? And that's where I've been since.
So walk us through a couple questions. Where'd you go to school, first of all, and get those great degrees?
George Washington University.
We need to plug the schools. I've been a lot of time giving my daughter as a GW graduate. But
there you go. Go GW. Good urbanism.
And so for people who don't know, that was the Salt Lake Olympics. And the Salt Lake Winter Olympics were very different because of the fact that they were back in the States, but because of the way they were run and the success, the business success that came along with that. So can you walk us through just a little bit before we get to the Jackson Family Wines and then Gallo and some of the other
stuff?
Sure.
I mean, as I mentioned,
why were they successful?
They were successful because it was a turning point for the Olympics, and there was a large bribery scandal and really talked about the men in suits, and the Olympics were very much run by business and by men in suits. And what we did is, I think the pivotal moment was we focused back on the athletes And I think that's been the success of sports ever since then. If you stay focused on the storytelling around your athletes. And so we really, even if you saw all of our ad campaigns and everything we did, it was always about the athletes. So when you walked into downtown Salt Lake City in February of 2002, you saw large banners with focus on the athletes. And so that was sort of a pivotal thing. It was also a period, as I said, 6 months after 9/11, where we were really trying to think about the sponsors didn't want to come. Even some of the athletes didn't want to come. There's large security concerns. It's hard to put on games in the United States because unlike other Olympic games, we have to really earn the money ourselves here in America. So sponsors were really a critical key. So it was about relationships. Mitt had a lot of relationships. It was about being very transparent with the media. I'd say it was a very closed organization prior to Mitt's arrival. And so we opened up. And so we opened up our books, our board of directors meetings. We had weekly, monthly interactions and media plays with the press. And so I think that led to the focus on the athletes and being more transparent in everything we did was part of the success story and welcoming the world.
Cool. So the Olympics end, and as maybe not a lot of people understand, a lot of those jobs, and you've invested all this time, just kind of go up into the ether. So you got to figure out, almost like a political campaign, where you're going to go next when that run is over, no matter how positive or negative it is. You stay in Utah, you work for Larry Miller's company. Again, an organization very traditional, not a boat rocking organization, the Jazz, minor league baseball team, a lot of his other businesses. How did the lessons learned during the Salt Lake Olympics transfer to get you to the NBA?
I think it was about innovative thinking. And I think a lot of times, both in wine and in sports, you know, you get the intern who's done a great job and sort of worked themselves up through to the higher ranks of an organization. Well, that's certainly one way to do it. But I think it's really important that you also have the skill set. So I'm actually seeing that out in the marketplace today in the wine industry specifically. It's like the homegrown talent versus the, I know I'm digressing from your question, versus people coming in with MBAs into the business. And so I think you have to never lose sight of the fundamental skill sets for the jobs that you're working in. And it's been a challenge as I come in and look at new organizations, I think, across my portfolio. But that was one of the things with the Jazz. It was time to sort of take a good assessment of the communications team and really upgrade the talent that we had there and really focus in on the business of the game, and how or what we were doing with our communications outreach, really filling seats. It was a transitional time for the Jazz when I joined, and you know, Karl Malone and John Stockton had left, and so it was how do we get Jerry Sloan, you know, rest his soul, and all the others really thinking differently about engaging players and the organization. And that stems from being out in the community. I think no matter where you are and what you're doing, you always need to be part of your community and stay connected to community. And the Miller family was very much part of that, but the players weren't. And so one of the fun things we did there was give out preseason tickets. And we really went out and had the players hand them out personally so they could be a connection to the players at a school, at a library, at a grocery store, where you're like, you know, hey, Roger, this is Roger Bell on aisle 3, come see me for some tickets. So it's just thinking more innovatively. And I remember the president of the Jazz told me, Jerry Sloan will let you do this, I'm all for it, but there's no way you'll convince him to do some of the things that we did that were pushing the needle. And that comes from trust. You really have to build trust and get that credibility with the people you work with to really push the needle in a different way.
Cool. And we're going to touch on trust and over communicating and some of the things that have translated throughout your jobs, but making a transition, and then you basically leave sports, right? Is that when you went to KB Home at that point?
Yeah, I did. It was an opportunity to get into a big metropolitan market, which I think I'm trying to gear this a bit to your students. So that's not the direction.
You're touching on every point. Actually, at the end, we're going to have no questions. So that works out really well. So
I really think that everyone should spend some time in a major metropolitan city, be it Chicago, New York, LA, and to really test your skill set. it's very different from a second tier market like Salt Lake City, or I live in sleepy agricultural Sonoma County right now, to really test your mettle and see how your ideas grow. And so I really wanted the opportunity to go and live in LA and work at a Fortune 500 company to see how that's different. And it was a huge difference. Transitioning from a family organization to working for a Fortune 500 company, it was all about the shareholders. And what I learned about myself there is I'd rather work for a family company. I like to look at the long-term vision and really see where we are, where the family stands on social justice issues or where they stand on investing in their employees. When you work for a Fortune 500 company, it's really about it truly is about the shareholders. I will say I probably made the most money there than I've made anywhere, but money's not everything.
Right. And what were some of the differences working for a publicly traded company in the housing business at the time? Was that a time when that housing business was booming, or was that around, that was around the bubble, right?
It's right around the bubble. And so there again, you take some of those lessons learned from the, you know, every job you have to take the good and, you know, keep remembering those pieces. And so that transparency played a big part when it went imploded. KB Home, actually, our chairman was walked out with the Department of Justice, and there was a large scandal. And when scandals hit, I think the most important thing, and this is a tip for crisis communications professionals, is separate the business, separate the individual from the business. So the very first thing we did when we had the backdating scandal at KB Home was really to take the individual, the CEO, and spin the story this way and talk about that, and then really manage that through legal. That's the big difference when you're working shareholder versus family. I think every nuance is managed through attorneys. And then the second piece was to stay focused on the product. So we are winning awards for some of our designs in Texas. It's a national organization company in Texas and other places. So talk about those environmental awards you were getting and talk about new communities opening. So when a crisis hits, the people are separate from the company. And that's the way to do it, in my opinion.
So you go from there into another very public industry, but one owned by a family. And it's your first kind of real foray into the spirits business, which is a little bit different, especially given all the time you spent in Utah.
You can get a drink in Utah. Don't
worry. You just know where to go. I get that. But anyway, so you get to tell us about Jackson Family Wines, which people probably don't know. And the two things I think that are important that if you could communicate is, it's like someone saying, I work for Pepsi. And they say, oh, you work for Pepsi. And you close your eyes and you see the Pepsi logo, when in reality, it's 30 different brands that you could be working for in sub-brands. So walk us through a little bit of both Gallo and, but first starting with Jackson Family Wines, about the depth and scope of the business, you know, and the opportunities that you came across there, because there's so many companies, I would imagine, that are involved in both.
So the Jackson family is exclusively wine and exclusively a premium wine company. And you're right, people didn't know, and purposely, many of these companies purposely, these family-owned wineries keep their name behind the scenes and really stay focused on the product, on the wine itself. So Jackson Family Wine is best known for Kendall Jackson. It's the number one, still to this day, the number one selling Chardonnay in the United States at a premium price point. So they never want to touch the golden goose, if you will, when it comes to doing innovative communications around. They have about 50 wine brands, mostly in that very upper tier luxury, the $400-$500 bottles of wine. And I'd say their average price point is about $50 and $25 to $50. And they really do focus on their premium portfolio and engaging with collectors and the high-end restaurants that you see and sommeliers. What I've really enjoyed in the time at the Gallo family, and I will say both families really do take a long-term vision for the land and for their organizations. And that's, I'm very, very blessed to work for the two of the most preeminent family-run organizations in wine. Like they both care about sustainability. I think an interesting note to share with your listeners is that agriculture accounts for 20% of the carbon footprint out in the world today. Now, wine is only 1.8% of that, but it's a reason why anyone in ag needs to really stay focused on sustainability and the environment. I'd like to talk about the Gallo family. What attracted me to them is that they have a much broader portfolio. And what makes them exciting to me is their whole mantra really is, how do we win new friends for wine? And how do we really broaden the occasion where wine is involved and enjoyed? And I think the reason I took the job is Stephanie Gallo. I heard her speak, and then she and I were chatting, and she said, we need to democratize wine because it needs to look more like America. And nothing to detract from what the Jackson family was doing in terms of the premium set, but let's be honest, you know, the average wine drinker, you know, they enter the category at under $10. So the Jackson family wines are one that you aspire to a certain extent. And the Gallo wines are so broad and deep that there's an opportunity to bring everyone into the category and enjoy it. Because in my humble opinion, every story is better when shared with a glass of wine. And I feel blessed to be in this industry because very much like sports, there is some connectivity there that they connect people. They're relevant. So it's, you know, sports, no matter, it doesn't matter what your economic social status is or your ethnic identity or your gender, it brings people together. And I think wine does that too. Wine and spirits do that in a very special way.
For those who don't know, can you rattle off just a few of the Gallo brands?
Absolutely. Happy to rattle away. Our probably most popular is Barefoot Wines. Everyone's relatively familiar with Barefoot, Dark Horse, Apothic, Andre. At the higher end that competes along with the Jackson Family Wines portfolio, it would be Jay Sparkling, Louis Martini, a winery that's been around for ages, very historic. Talbot. I mean, they have about 100 brands. They also own some preeminent spirits. High Noon. High Noon is, we can talk about the hard seltzer category and how that's just growing. Everyone is coming out with a hard seltzer. You know, High Noon, Pink Whitney. It's just endless.
So both Jackson Family and Gallo, how do you storytell? Do you pull people together? Are there silos that work for each one? Do you try and put together, are there unified messages other than you touched on social responsibility and kind of the agribusiness that work together? How does all that work, especially from kind of a brand marketing standpoint? Talk about Gallo specifically. Like, are there just Barefoot people and then there are people in the other brands, or is there a way that you've been brought in to try and figure out how to take one from one piece and put it against another one?
Yeah. So at both companies, actually the wine brands stand alone as do the spirits, their divisions. And so they are standalone because very similar to Pepsi, you want to think about that Pepsi bottle, right? You want to think about the bottle of Kendall Jackson or the bottle of Barefoot. So what they do is they're standalone brands. And what I would like to do at Gallo is really bring the family story to the forefront because it's probably the greatest wine story never told. They've been around since 1933 and still family owned and operated. Third generation now, my boss is a third generation of Ernest and Julio Gallo. I mean, Carlo Rossi, all those pretty preeminent brands that have been around a long time. So they are separate, but I think there are pieces that thread together in terms of how you tell that story. I think one of the things that we have to do is really inspire stories that curate is an important piece of the puzzle when we're talking about wine.
Explain that. What do you mean by that?
I mean that continue the conversation. I always try and tell my team, one, you know, why would the customer care about this storyline? How is this wine or spirit uniquely different? And is the story we're telling engaging enough for me to tell your friend about it? Was the product so amazing that you want to share that? Or was more the moment? I mean, I think that's what we're seeing right now. We all break out of COVID lockdown, is that you've seen that across the board. It's like we're anticipating the wine and spirits business, the roaring 20s to come back. So how are we going to be represented in all those moments that matter that haven't been part of the last, 14 months.
Mm-hmm. How does the differences, again, kind of contrasting and comparing from a social media standpoint, how Gallo handles social and what does that look like and how important is that versus when you were at Kendall Jackson, which was a few years ago, but how they handled their social in terms of value and resonance in the marketplace?
So at the premium, the upper echelons, they're less engaged on the social piece of it. I will say COVID taught everyone in the wine industry, whether you made 500 cases or 5 million cases, the importance of e-commerce for the obvious, right? I mean, that has just quadrupled. Gallo, had its best year ever last year because of the e-commerce business, and everyone was quick to get that started. For Gallo, it's extremely important. I mean, we are in places that the Jackson family would never play in. We're looking at TikTok and Clubhouse and Twitter, all those things. We're looking at way to stay culturally relevant. And so that's a critical piece of the storytelling and the communications outreach and working with influencers. And again, being authentic to having wine look like America, that Demrocker, that really, really inspires me, this having wine be more reflective of what America looks like. You know, you think of wine, you think of, white tablecloth restaurants, and it's not. It should be, one of the most preeminent master sommeliers in the world, there's only about 120 of them, said to me once, "Hey, Caroline, don't get so caught up in the scores and the verbiage. It's either yum or yuck." And that's really stuck with me. Yum or yuck. You either like it or you don't. Don't let someone preposition you as to what you may or may like. And I'll be honest, you can find a pretty good bottle of wine for $10, just as much as you can find a great bottle of wine for $100. But it's really about what your personal flavor is like, your profile.
Cool. Before we get to the forward thinking part of this, which is going to be talking about the seltzer business, which is continuing to grow, and especially as we go into a summer and how that's exploded in the last couple of years, no pun intended. Talk about a little bit about the ties to sports, because we're here now on the Friday, the last Friday of April. First Saturday in May is the Kentucky Derby, and horse racing will become a little bit more prominent. But the Jackson family was involved in the horse business. Was it more a personal business or a marketing piece? And then how do some of those brands now at Gallo translate to sports? We had a conversation about polo at one point, which I didn't think made any sense, but there are opportunities for brands in the wine space who have been, probably not as much as beer, but they've been involved. So how does sports, in terms of a marketing demo, especially given what you just talked about being the face of America, fit into the wine business, starting with Kendall Jackson and now obviously much more with Gallo?
Yeah. So first of all, horse racing and thoroughbred racing was at the heart of Jess Jackson. He grew up on a horse farm and saw Seabiscuit run. So they have thoroughbred farms in Kentucky. So it's a completely separate business owned and operated by their thoroughbred estates. So it was, it's very authentic to who the family is. And they have only this year really capitalized on that partnership where they have made Kendall Jackson sort of the official wine of horse racing to a certain extent with partnering up with, it's not just everyone thinks about the fastest 5 minute, whatever, 2 minutes in sports. It's not just about the Derby. It's about the Preakness and about the Belmont Stakes there in New York. So, and it's, I don't have to tell you, it's big business, horse racing and gambling. So they're integrating there by trying to have the wines represented. And the sports is, I have to laugh. No pun intended. I just picked up, this is the May 31st issue of Wine Spectator. And
we're going to talk about, and I want to talk about the athletes right after this.
I know the athlete piece of it. I was like, wow. So we're trying to, at Gallo, we have a brand called Dark Horse, and we're also trying to sort of engage there and get wine tied to horses and thoroughbred racing. And, when you go to your grocery store, pick up some Dark Horse for your horse racing party. But I guess it's more about going back to that point when I said earlier, it's being engaged in moments that matter and being engaged in things that you call, you bring people together for. And so that's where I'd like to see wine and spirits show up.
And you just held up the cover of Wine Spectator with Carmelo Anthony. Mm-hmm. It seems like every time we turn around, Caroline, there's some athlete who's suddenly a wine expert. I remember there was something during the bubble where you had Dwayne Wade and seven other players talking about, you know, their investment in wine and how much they love wine. How does the celebrity, especially now with Gallo, factor into the growth of the wine business? And is it a passing fancy, or is it something that, you know, you could actually leverage off of with a partnership with an athlete? On that,
it's not just athletes. It's actors and actor. I mean, it's everybody wants a wine brand, right? And so when I was at Jeff W, we did a partnership with Drew Barrymore as an example. And yes, and there are a lot of partnerships in wine with musicians and artists of all types, including athletes. I think it generates excitement and interest for the space. And so that excites me. Whether it turns into actual hard dollar sales, less so, because don't forget the average American, we drink wine in less than a 24 hour period. We buy it and then we drink it, versus in other societies, they store their wine and let it, you know.
And I would imagine even like, and it's funny that you bring that up, because I would imagine even the beer industry looks at it as you bring it home, you don't drink the entire thing right away, it kind of sits in your refrigerator for a while, as opposed to wine, which open, drink, move on to the next one. So,
I was just gonna say, I'm learning about this also. You know, I've got a wine background and a wine sort of, you know, level of certification, but I just learned that with seltzer, you have to drink it with like 90 days. Like wine, one of my children just turned 21 and we opened up a bottle of 1998 William Sion Pinot Noir, which doesn't ever, you know, that's not known to be ageable like Cabernet. And it was incredibly fruit forward and tasty. And so that's a 21-year-old bottle of wine. I learned last week that seltzer, because we're coming out with new seltzer product, 90 days. That's it. Got to drink it in 90 days or it goes bad.
So talk about a little bit about the growth into the seltzer business. I would imagine there's a brand out there that has a claw in the name that kind of really.
No, we don't want to talk about that brand.
Yeah, we don't want to talk about White Claw. We won't talk about them. But the amazing thing about the seltzer business is it built more on word of mouth, because you don't see a lot of marketing that's going towards it right now. It's just something that is becoming much more popular. How does Gallo get into that business?
Gallo's very much entrenched that business with High Noon. So that's going to change. I'm starting to see some streaming, Truly's out there streaming, and White Claw and others. So I think that they are starting to engage and put more levels of alcohol into it as well. I mean, you're seeing wine seltzers, vodka seltzers, you know, it's just the diversity. Someone's talking about a coffee-based seltzer, you know, Bud's into the category as well. It's just imploding. And so we're very much in the game, and we're looking to expand as much as we can in that category. Barefoot Wines has a seltzer as well. So it's continually growing. I think it's not word of mouth. I think it's who gets in the cold box and who has the biggest stacks at the grocery store right now.
Interesting. And because the question off of that is, when people go looking for wines in a store and they're not getting any advice, they tend to look at labels. So is the labeling and the naming of particular wines more prominent than other businesses that you've been in, where that's kind of the decision point? I buy that because it's a cool label. I don't really know anything about it. Or is it still kind of like the bait and switch? You get somebody to buy it because of a name, and then they come back and they're more brand loyal. Or is it based on the label, and how long is the brand loyalty? Will people buy one wine because they like it, or will they switch it up?
Yeah. So wine is an exploratory product, beverage. And so people like to try different wines. And you're right. If you don't know anything, if you've never been to the Russian River Valley where I live in Sonoma County, and you don't know that it's got a cherry cola fruit forward Pinot Noir that resonates with your palate.
I was just going to say that, as a matter of fact. So anyway.
You're going to go for that label. So label design is incredibly important. I think that's across any marketer, you know, what the product looks like. And you're seeing that evolution all the time with products. So a wine label is, yes, very, very important. We hope to educate people about regions. And I like to always push local, of course. But yeah, the wine label is very, very important. But wine, to your point, it's hard to build brand loyalty in the wine category because it's an exploratory product, very much unlike spirits. I'm learning that as I join the Gallo organizations. Mm. At wine, if you don't have Jay sparkling, I will say, okay, I'll pick up another bottle of sparkling wine or champagne, right? Because I'm at the grocery store and I want to make mimosas this weekend, which is trending high. Mimosas is like the most number one Google search in the alcoholic beverage business for this past week. I thought that was fascinating. Mm. How to make a mimosa. So odd tidbit, Joe, sorry. But what's interesting is that if you go in and your Jack Daniels isn't at your local liquor store, you're going to keep searching for your Jack Daniels. Does that make sense? So it's
it's funny. That was the brand I was going to bring up, is people associate Jack Daniels with not just a lifestyle, but it's almost ubiquitous, like Xerox. When people think about it, they think they're drinking Jack Daniels versus a wine, where there's so many different choices when you walk into a store, and you probably know more about either a color or something that you like versus what brand it is. And sometimes, because like you said, the brands can be, I don't want to say diluted, but there's so many brands that could fall under one company that you may not know that you're drinking a Gallo wine because there's no path to show what brand that is, correct?
Absolutely. And so what I would hope, and it would be the long haul, is that when you see a Gallo product and you know the Gallo family name, that you would know that means quality in a bottle and value at the price point. And so that's what I'd like to see the team that I work with do in the next 3 to 5 years, is really have that representation, a little bit like Procter Gamble, maybe to a certain extent, if you have a sense of that product. But touching back to seltzer, you know, people who are Bud Light loyalists will probably pick up a Bud Seltzer at least to try it, right?
Right.
So you know, brand loyalty is important. I will say one of my last comment is though on that is that if you do see a wine that you know they've grown, you know, when you're trying to impress the in-laws or your first date, you are gonna, that's when that brand loyalty piece comes in. You're like, okay, well, I had, you know, Dark Horse or Apothic before at the grocery store. I'm gonna bring that bottle with me, or if I see it on a menu, I'll purchase it. So, you know, you don't wanna take chances there.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about kind of that brand pyramid. You mentioned Procter & Gamble, but I would imagine General Motors is kind of the same thing, where you're either going to buy a Cadillac or you're going to buy a different one, but you know the GM brand is one that you want. Couple of other quick questions to think about. The U.S. wine business versus the global wine business. And if you're a consumer or a marketer in the U.S., how much more attention do you pay to competing against American brands versus European brands? And then the other piece of that, because you spent a lot of time in your career around social responsibility, how does, with the growth of this industry, how does responsibility and responsible drinking factor into the messages that Gallo especially has to communicate?
So I'll take the first one first. It's very hard for American wines to compete in wine growing countries, right? So it's very hard to win, to sell our wines, to export wines to Italy or France or, you know, Chile or Argentina. And I think wine plays a role geographically. Nothing frustrates me more than going to a restaurant in Manhattan where you see no California wines. It's very European centric, right? In California, it's the opposite, right? It's, you see a lot of California wines. So not a lot. We pretty much dominate the wine list in California with some unique European or South American or Australian or New Zealand. I mean, it's a global business, as you mentioned. So that's sort of the scene. I would say that California is the number one producer of wine, and California is the number one exporter of wine. But it's a challenge because people, as I said earlier, want to explore. So you want to try what, and that's great. I want people to explore. I want them to try new varietals and test a New Zealand Sauv Blanc against a Californian Sauv Blanc, right? Test the Whitehaven up against a Matanzas Creek as an example.
And then on the social responsibility side, how does that factor in, especially today where you're trying to get people to consume more, the drinking responsibly messages, which obviously have caused beer, especially the beer category, to kind of take a step back, especially on the college side for a long time. Now they're obviously more involved because of the drinking age. But so how do you factor that into kind of the strategy on the marketing and the communication side?
So everything we do focuses around drinking responsibly, both at the Gallo organization and throughout the wine industry. We're a very highly regulated organization, federally regulated. So even when we do our advertising, our models, for lack of a better term, have to be 25 or older, even though 21 is legal drinking age. So, but that's very important to us. You know, we want everyone to drink like all the alcoholic beverage businesses. And I would say, as we look at social issues and sustainability, and we're now creating sort of at Gallo, a sustainability approach, responsible drinking is one of those pillars that is very important to the family and to the organization. So we take that quite seriously.
Great. And then last two questions. One is, given all the businesses that you've been involved with throughout your career in the various places, how do you stay constant and also translate those either communications or marketing skills from what you learned when you were on the political side or at the Olympics or KB to what you're doing now? That's number one. And then number two is, if someone, a young person or someone transitioning, really has a passion for the wine and spirits industry, what are some of the skills that you look for? So how do you stay constant? And then what are the skills that people should have?
I think I personally stay constant in terms of always learning, being curious, and trying to stay culturally relevant. So I read I'm a huge podcaster. So this is near and dear to my heart. I had to add the cusp to my list. As you may know, I'm a distance runner. So, I listen almost every day to The Daily and The Times, Vine Pair, which is an industry podcast. And I like to listen to Brené Brown on Dare to Lead, keeps me grounded. For a young person, I think learning about WSET is a certification that I would recommend somebody drinking as much and tasting as much and learning as much as they can about the product. But one of the things, and I touched on this early on, is whether you're in marketing or communications or finance or e-commerce, it's don't forget the fundamentals. You know, more and more people just learning how to write and how to engage is some really how to communicate. Don't forget who your audience is. I think we can get, especially in wine, we can get really caught up on ourselves, and that's bad. You have to remember who you're speaking to.
Cool. Any other skills? Now, you obviously, before we came on, you talked about, you know, your two young people who are in the process of graduating and starting the rest of their lives. Other skills that you think translate across industries that are important to have, other than the ones you mentioned about writing and curiosity?
My guiding principle across my life has been collaboration, creativity, and communications. So I call them the Caroline three C's. It's been really something that's always been important. I think paying it forward, I know that sounds very trite, but it's true. And at a more senior level, I think it's really important to let others shine. It's not about yourself, it's about others at this point in my career. But for students, I just had my daughter do this, is she's very interested in becoming a civil rights lawyer. So I had her go and I searched my network high and low and asked people for recommendations. So she spoke to five people in that business. And now she's got her friends calling me who are interested in sports. So again, that networking piece. So a young person out there, go to your parents. They know people, and say who in their network, who people want to help. You know, that's through, especially during COVID, but pre-COVID, people are kind and generous, and they want us. And you're probably one of the most kindest, generous, gracious persons I know, Joe. So it's an honor to know you and be your friend.
Cool. Well, that's a good way to end this. I like the way to end it that way. Caroline, last question is for people who want to find more about not just the wine side of Gallo, but the business side of Gallo, where can they go to find out more about the business?
Both family organizations, and Miller, Jackson's, Gallo, don't share their internal business goals, but you can always follow them on industry trades, wineindustry.com. That's really probably where I go to keep up to speed on what the competitors are doing and what I'm doing.
Cool. Well, we raise a glass to you, Caroline Shaw. Thank you for joining us on the Cusp Show this week. As I said, we have never really talked about the wine and spirits industry, plus your kind of diverse career through the Olympics and the home industry and the politics side has been great. I think we learned a lot. We learned about the three C's, Tom Cerny and I, which we didn't know about. And now we kind of picked that up and lots of little trivia and really interesting insight into a business that we hadn't talked about before. So Caroline Shaw, once again, thanks for joining us on the Cusp Show tonight.
My pleasure.
Once again, this has been the Columbia University Sports Podcast, The Cusp Show. Our guest has been Caroline Shaw of the Gallo Family Wines, talking about the marketing and the communication side, not just of the wine business, but all the places she's been in her career. I'm Joe Favorito for my co-host, Tom Richardson, and our producer, Tom Cerny. We'll see you down the road.